Don, we were talking about
Don McGannon,
the hierarchy in the Westinghouse Broadcasting. Don McGannon is very famous in broadcasting, very well-known man. But we had a personal relationship in addition to being my boss and head of this giant corporate structure. He was a nice guy, and his wife liked me. They liked me because I was covered sensational news. I was really famous. Covered a lot of shootings here in Pittsburgh, and big stories, fires, floods. And I was kind of like their pet. And I was running wild. I covered national stories, the space program, and interviewed, I met every president that's ever been alive in my lifetime. And so I was considered something of a freak, kind of a phenomenon, a hell-bent for leather newsman that they sent me all over the country covering news stories, because KDKA was the flagship station of the Westinghouse Broadcasting Company chain. And they knew me and that they liked me. And when I told them that I wanted to quit because I was working too hard, McGannon, a vice president named Dick Pack, and a couple of the other vice presidents, we had a conference, and I told them that I couldn't really keep up this pace anymore and I was going to leave. And I didn't have another job at that time. I had been offered an interview, and CBS was favorably inclined to hire me when I went to New York. Unfortunately, when I went to New York, the people, when I rode from the airport into the city, people were walking around with radios, portable radios, held to their ear. It was phenomenal, the number of people on the street listening to radios, and I didn't know what the hell was happening. It turned out that the Arabs had attacked the state of Israel that day. And here I was, scheduled with an appointment to the leadership of the broadcasting company that I wanted out, and that I was determined to quit, and I was going to combine this meeting with them to resign with the meeting with the big shots at CBS to go to work for them. The interviews at CBS were a wipeout, and they were terribly distracted while I was talking to them. I know to this day they never heard a word I said, because they were trying to get this huge news story on the air, and all of the big shots at CBS were wondering how the hell to cover a story. They didn't have any live transmissions. We didn't have satellites, and we didn't have a videotape then, and they're wondering how to cover a news story in the far-off Middle East, or Far East, Middle East story without any pictures to back it up, and they were concerned about that, and so, hell, I left CBS after having had three frustrating experiences talking to people who were not the least interested in considering a new kid, let alone hiring me and giving me a news assignment that day. So I had to leave, and went to Westinghouse and turned in my resignation there, and they begged and persuaded me not to leave the company, and that something would happen. Well, eventually, a week or so later, I was offered the job as a newsman in New York, and I went there and worked there for two and a half years in New York City as a newsman.
What happened with Mayor Lindsay?
There was a race riot of some kind in in Harlem. And I went to New York City.
Was that the one in relationship to Columbia University?
No, this was much earlier.
Okay, nothing to do with
this
Attica.
This was race.
Okay.
This was a street demonstration in Harlem. Hell, I didn't know Harlem from Harmerville. It's anyhow, when I went to my first day on the job, they gave me a car, radio-equipped car to broadcast my news from. They also gave me a helmet with a plastic visor and a bulletproof vest. I didn't expect this, and I didn't know what the hell was coming off. But that was the nature of the community in those days. I mean, there was trouble on the streets of New York City. And I was going to be given a few weeks of indoctrination, riding around, covering news with the other newsmen. Well, I went back to my hotel after my first day, getting equipment, a tape recorder, and being given instructions on how to use the two-way radio in the car, instructions on how to drive, where to drive, a map of the city. There was a code where you could figure out locations on the main avenues and streets in Manhattan according to their numbers, and I forget the formula now, but it was getting around New York City is not easy. And my first day on the job, I went back to the hotel and I got a telephone call to go out on the street to cover a goddamn story. And I went, and there is a rioting mob on the street of black people, and I can't tell you what they were rioting about. I mean, they were rioting. Because when I got out of my car, I pulled up to where there was a cluster of white people who I immediately spotted as dignitaries, officials, city officials and authorities, and I got out of the car, and a man who was later identified to me as the police commissioner said, "Where's your helmet?" They were all wearing helmets, and I had to go back to the car to put on some damn helmet that they'd given me. I didn't know what the heck I'd gotten into. And eventually they, with tear gas and mobs of police and the whole bit, they get things quieted down. And this guy, Lindsay, has a curbside interview, a news conference with the mayor. And I happened to be directly alongside him with my tape recorder running. And I asked him, now that they got things under control, what next? And he looked at me as though I was a worm, and he said, "I'm going to take a deep breath." To which I looked at him and said, "That's a stupid thing for the mayor of a big city to say. What are you going to do now?" Well, he didn't like my referring to him as the author of a stupid statement, but it did get the interview back on schedule, and he gave me an answer that he's going to communicate with some of the leaders of the community there, and they're going to try to walk the streets and to calm down, pacify the people. It was a particular housing project that was up in arms about some problem that they had, and they were really angry at the city administration and were literally rioting, throwing rocks and bottles. And a favorite weapon was were whiskey bottles filled with urine, and they were throwing rocks and bottles, which was explained why I was told to get my helmet. And first day on the job, that was my introduction, my baptism in New York City, and my introduction to the mayor. And from that moment on, we were enemies. He hated me. And of course, I had to sit, whenever he did have a formal press conference in City Hall, I had to sit in the front row, right as close as I could get to his eyesight, so that I could rub it into him. And he wasn't not much as a mayor, and I thought that was pretty hot stuff as a reporter, and that got us off on a very bad footing, which I'm proud to say was exactly the way you should deal with John Lindsay, because he was kind of a wipeout as a mayor. But that started off a couple of years of really exciting news coverage for me in New York City.
When did you come back to Pittsburgh, and could you give me some idea of exactly how you started and why you got started as a talk show?
Oh, while I was in New York, I came in off the street with tape to edit on a story, and I was told that the general manager of KDKA, a guy named Bill Hartman, wanted to see me as soon as I was free, and he was in the general manager's office. Eventually I did meet him, and we had a little conference in the hall. But after I edited the tape, I went out and I bumped into this guy, and he knew me and introduced himself and said that they were having problems with the ratings. That's significant. It's very important in broadcasting. Their nighttime ratings were slipping badly. And they had, in fact, fallen down to third place in the market, which was, at that time, unheard of. KDKA was dominant in every day part, morning, noon, and night. They were accustomed to owning the community. And he knew that I had had experience doing a talk show. And he wanted me to come back to KDKA to do nothing but a talk show in the evening. And I told him that I was happy there in New York. I was making good money. I was becoming known in New York City, the audience. I was becoming familiar to the listeners. I was beginning to develop contacts in New York City. The governor and I were friends. He was a guy named Nelson Rockefeller. He was a pretty neat guy. I had met Nelson Rockefeller earlier, much earlier, when he was the governor, freshman governor, and I had seen him mature in office, and by the time I got to be a reporter, he was governor, and I would meet him at, the governor had an office in 55th Street in New York City, and I liked him a lot. And he liked me, I think, and we became friends, sort of. As a newsman, you don't really befriend people, but I was developing contacts, becoming known in the community, and I didn't want to go back to Pittsburgh. I remember Jeffrey, a little kid, he was in his teens, and they were becoming sophisticated New Yorkers by then. And he said, gee, Dad, I don't mind leaving New York, but gee, Pittsburgh. We did go back to Pittsburgh for the simple reason that this guy Hartman, I later learned to be a rather ruthless man, had already severed. He knew exactly what I was going to do because I left my meeting with him, and he told me that I should not make up my mind, but that if I didn't go back to Pittsburgh, there would be no job for me in New York. And he wanted me to do the talk show in Pittsburgh, but don't answer him right away. Think it over. I, of course, ran to WCBS and asked the news editor there to put me to work. And he said he had been, his bosses had been talked to by the bosses at WINS, and that he couldn't hire me. He couldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. Okay, that's the way they play the game in Westinghouse. So I went to WMCA. Whoa. They were covering a lot of news then, too. And son of a gun, if the news director there said the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get a job. I had to go back to Pittsburgh. And I didn't want to. We had a lovely home in Teaneck. And we were members of a Jewish congregation there, Temple. I can't remember the name of it, but Markey had his bar mitzvah there, and our family came. We had a lovely bar mitzvah in New York City, and the kids were making friends. They were in school there. I didn't want to uproot them, and I didn't want to go back to Pittsburgh, and I tried desperately to get a job elsewhere, and I couldn't. So I called him and said, yeah, I'd been thinking over his offer, and I felt that I really ought to accept it. It would be in my best interest. And they moved us back to Pittsburgh. Gee, Dad, Pittsburgh. But we did come back, and we went to Mount Lebanon, and it was traumatic for the kids. Bernice and I didn't mind. I had a good job. It was a good job. The money was good. And I loved the work. And I was my own show, and, you know, the thrill of doing the Mike Levine show. They had full-size billboards all over the city about open mic was the name of the program. They had a kind of a picture of a microphone being opened, and inside was the face of Mike Levine. And Bill, when you see your name, Mike Levine is coming back, open mic returns, the billboards all over town. It was a big ego trip for me. It was tough for the kids who had to leave their New York friends behind and make new friends in Pittsburgh. But that's how I happened to come back and to start the talk show. I had been doing the magazine show, as I told you, and in the last year, half year or so, of that talk show, I did a kind of a newscast, kind of a folksy sort of Will Rogers kind of newscast about what happened in Pittsburgh that day. I used the outtakes from the interviews that I had had with people around town. And I did news of entertainment that wasn't routine in radio newscasts in that day. I did obituaries, which no radio newscast then or now. There were many people who were not necessarily famous, but prominent people in the community who would never get an obituary mentioned. You don't hear it to this day. But I did unusual things like that on that program, and it was very well received. But then I went to New York to get away from all of the exhausting work. And when I came back to Pittsburgh to do the talk show, I was not exactly unfamiliar with it. And they helped me with a producer who would help line up guests and get study material. And I worked very hard at what I did. I came back, and before the show went on the air, I was doing familiarization work around the city. And in my travels, I was out in Oakland, and I stopped in the library to do some research material on my first guest. The first talk show guest was a young man who had been a prodigy, musical prodigy, and was directed a symphony orchestra in short pants.
Lauren Mazel?
No. Who was the musical director before Lauren Mazel?
Oh, Andre Previn.
He was the child prodigy. He was a composer, a conductor, and the pianist.
So was Lauren Mazel.
Yeah. He was a pianist long before he became the musical director here. And he was at that time composing music for movies.
With his wife.
I suppose it's widely known that he did a lot of movies.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. He was unmarried then. But I happened to be passing the Carnegie Library, and I learned that Andre Previn, whose name was rather well known as a composer of popular music, as well as classical kind of music. And I looked him up in the in Who's Who and Celebrity Guide, and I had a lot of information about him, thank God. Because when I put him on the air, I did a one-hour interview and nobody called. Didn't get one telephone call for the guy. I kept asking for phone calls, people who wanted to talk to this prodigious artist. Nobody called. But I was able to do the interview because I had a sheet, a page full of notes, copious notes about his career and his accomplishments. And I was able to talk to him. It was kind of frightening with a famous artist and no phone calls, no support from the audience. But that was my first guest, and that was a start. And eventually it developed, but I never ever, from that moment on, never went into the studio unprepared. I always had information, lively and stimulating topics, controversial topics, issues in which there was a pro and a con, decided points of view for and against. And in order to generate interest and to stimulate telephone calls, I would frequently have to take an adversary view to whoever called to try to generate some give and take. And that is how I became an adversary, sort of controversial. People remember me as being outrageous and flamboyant and argumentative. But it stems from trying very hard to develop a program and to stimulate people to call and to get a back-and-forth dialogue. Yet it all gets back to Andre Previn. He made me what I became. It was his fault.
It was his fault. Did you ever see him when he became a director here of the symphony or not?
I saw him play and conduct a couple weeks ago, and I didn't want to bother him.
Yeah.
I didn't want to bother him. I don't suppose he knows that he was my first guest. Or if he knew at that time, I'm sure he doesn't remember. He must have done a zillion talk shows since then.
What happened to the rating?
We were badly behind a couple of other stations, and before very long, we were back to number one. I wanted to develop some heavy-duty ratings, and I did. I eventually got to the point where I got more than a 30 share. Well, that's unheard of in broadcasting. Single-digit numbers, ratings, are the order of the day for most radio stations, and to have more than a 30 share of the audience was incredible. And I did just get over a 30 share at the time when my program was at its most popular. But I did a lot of guests.
How long did it last?
What, another decade or so, I suppose. We came back around 1970, maybe a 71, and I guess a decade. Don't hold me to that. I don't know. There were a lot of guests and a lot of topics and a lot of talk shows, and it became a community fixture. It became very well known. Everybody was famous who were coming through town, did the talk show. It was great. It was fun. And I had a very good time. People knew that. And eventually came a point where we had a falling out. Over, I thought I should get a raise in pay because the ratings had gone up. And I had a very hard-nosed guy, this Bill Hartman, who was a tough cookie, really tough guy, loathsome man. And I think in his own perverse sort of way, liked me a lot. But he was the kind of a general manager of a radio station where he would go to the grave before, if he decided that he was going to put a particular talent to work for less money than he had been getting, he would die rather than give that performer a raise. And what happened is we reached a stalemate, and I quit. And that's how we happened to move to Florida. By then the kids were raised, and Bernice and I went to, I was offered a job in Florida, and hated it. Went there, and we were in exile from Pittsburgh about 10 years. Before I was given an opportunity to come back to the same job at the same time at the same station, and I jumped at it. Now, I've told you about the marvelous people I worked with at KDKA. These people, at the Sun-Telegraph at first, these people have always been a strong influence in my life. I worked with some great newspaper men at the Sun-Telegraph. I worked with, at KDKA, some of the most talented people who have ever performed in broadcasting. I didn't have the first talk show. I had one of the early talk shows in radio. But the people who had the very first talk show were Ed and Wendy King. It's impossible to find out whether they were the very first ones on the air or not with a talk show. But Ed King was a brilliant, prodigious writer and producer, and his wife Wendy was a marvelous performer and writer. I worked with Reach Kordick, who I've told you was on in the morning, and he had a stable of performers who worked with him who were tremendously clever, brilliant talent. The newsroom that I worked with, Jim Snyder as news director, is one of the most capable executives in journalism in America today. There was a guy named Paul Long. There was a guy named Al McDowell. There was a sports editor and director, newsman was Tom Bender. Adam Lynch was in the newsroom then. And oh, I know I'm overlooking a lot of people, but they were brilliant performers. Every one of them tried to do his very best. They aspired. They were driven and capable and talented performers, and in their daily way of life, tried to do a good job. I think that is totally absent from the American work scene today. I worked in New York with some brilliant people. I've met people who worked for the competition who were marvelous news people. A lot of people on the network news today. Ed Bradley was a street reporter with me. He's now at 60 Minutes. I met Mike Wallace. Mike Wallace worked for Westinghouse Broadcasting Company. He worked with Sid Davis. Sid Davis was is now a an executive with ABC. No, CBS. He was in charge of the CBS News Bureau in New York City. Dave Kelly. Dave Kelly and Al Julius and I went on an outing yesterday. We went for a bachelor's day off. We had a field trip. We went to Antietam Battlefield. These are men who I've worked with back in those days. Al Julius was at that time a newsman at KQV. Dave Kelly worked for the Washington Post, I think. Came to Pittsburgh and eventually became my boss. He was the news director at KDKA. And at a time when we had a combined newsroom, he was the news director for both radio and TV. Dave Kelly's a brilliant, talented, prodigious guy, fabulous, and a dear friend. We had a terrific day yesterday at Antietam. We got the VIP tour. We had a guide who took us around and showed us the battlefield where it was probably the most tragic in terms of loss of life battle in the history of America. But we drove down to Maryland together, and we had a good time. We had breakfast, lunch, and dinner today. And we get together once in a while at Chiodo's down in West Homestead at the end of the bridge, and we drink beer and talk about the old days. But here I go, babbling on, meandering.
You're not babbling.
I have met many famous people, but the people with whom I worked were some of the most brilliant, talented, capable people who ever lived. This guy, Ed King, for instance, could write stories that would make you cry and laugh, and boy, was he a brilliant writer.
What about Al Julius?
Al Julius has had a strange career. Al Julius is wanted to be a rabbi, wanted to be an actor, and I suppose he never did make up his mind, but he studied for the rabbinate. He studied to be an actor. And I guess the tug of the theater was stronger on him than the pull. But he is, to this day, a very devout Orthodox Jew. But he acted and he performed. And he has been a talk show host, a commentator, and newsman in broadcasting, radio and TV, almost as long as I have.
You think he's good?
Well, he's brilliant. He's very capable. He doesn't personalize things as much as I do. I not only personalize things, but I express a very firm opinion, position on many of the things that I talk about, the issues and the topics that I deal with. But these are men who are informed, capable, talented performers in an era before the delivery of news to the product is now delivered by people who are not journalists. They are stage presences. Ken and Barbie. They are readers in the sense of the British were the first, I suppose, who developed this business of having personalities read in clipped diction and perfect phrasing, people who read the news but did not necessarily cover it. Kelly, Julius, Bill Burns We wanted to have Bill go on the outing with us yesterday, but these are men who covered stories, wrote about it, and then read their own writings, their own thoughts on the air.
Do you think Al Joyce communicates with the audience as much as you did?
Sure. Yeah, he's a hippie-looking kind of a guy with his beard and his stubborn refusal to wear a necktie, and he has a way of being able to communicate to the beat people.
Do you think there's a difference between communicating through television rather than just by sound and radio?
Well, my way of broadcasting involved a process that I can't express it, but there developed between me and the listener it was more than just talking to them or at them. People who listened to my talk show would take me into their homes, and it was a very personal thing. There was a relationship developed between the listener and the people in the studio, the guest or the host of the show.